It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hello, beautiful listeners. It's your host, Tembi Locke. Welcome to Lifted, a podcast that pulls back the curtain on creativity, resilience, and the extraordinary moments when everything changes. Yasmin Khan sits at the intersection of food and travel. She's a British-born writer raised in London by her Pakistani father and her Iranian mother. She's a graduate of the London School of Economics and worked as a human rights campaigner lobbying UK parliamentarians about human rights abuses in the Middle East. And after 12 years of that social justice work, she experienced extreme burnout, ultimately ending up at her family's farm near the Caspian Sea. She is now a best-selling cookbook author and tells stories and builds empathy through food. Her three books, The Saffron Tales, Zutan, and Ripe Figs, have each received distinguished recognition, including a New York Times Best Cookbook of the Year. Our conversation goes in so many unexpected places, and I loved learning how she uses her cookbooks as a medium to bridge cultures and introduce readers to recipes and stories of everyday people throughout the regions of the Middle East. My conversation with Yasmin Khan was recorded before October 7th, 2023.
Yasmin, welcome to the Lifted podcast. I am so honored to have you here today.
Thank you so much, Tembi. I feel the same. I was so pleased when I kind of got the message, kind of inviting me on. I feel like even though we come from quite different, you know, worlds, there's so much synergy in some of the things that we've spoken about, that we're passionate about. I'm just really looking forward to this conversation. And thank you so much for everything that you do.
I believe when Saffron Tales came out, you were here at Now Serving, which is a bookstore here in LA, an independent bookstore here in LA that sells cookbooks. Shout out to Now Serving. And you were there in person, and I was riveted by your story, your conversation, your approach to that cookbook, and it stayed with me. And so lo these many years later, here we are chatting, and I want to get right into it. I like to begin with an origin story of sorts. And if you could tell me a little bit about sort of both what your parents did for a living, where you grew up, and like, how was food centered in your life? Or was food centered in your life?
Well, I have a very mixed heritage, which is a real blessing for me. The older I get, the more I recognize that actually it's been such a gift. So my mom is from Iran and my dad is from Pakistan. I grew up mainly in the UK. So I've got kind of a lot of different influences happening. And even within Iran and Pakistan, you know, my mom's from the north of Iran, which has its own culture, its own cuisine. My family on my mom's side are farmers. So we had a small rice farm growing up, which as a kid was just so fun to run around in with my cousins, you know, like playing in the sun, like grabbing watermelons, taking them down to a stream. Yeah, we were so lucky. And at the same time, my dad's family is from Punjab, again, like an area of the subcontinent with a really strong identity. So I guess the reason why I'm sharing all of that is now, you know, as a woman in her 40s, I really feel that it's so important to celebrate these kind of aspects of our heritage and really dig deep. And for me, it's been a real pleasure to be able to share that through my cookbooks and through the work that I've done.
Growing up with parents from such rich food traditions, who did the cooking in your home?
You know, it was actually both of my parents. My dad's a brilliant cook. My mom is a brilliant cook. Actually, my mom didn't like cooking. She was a nutritionist and dietetic, like she has a PhD in nutrition. And we definitely had a traditional food culture where there was a home-cooked meal every day, you know. But I feel like my mom you know, it's not her favorite thing. Whereas my dad kind of quite enjoyed it. And I think the food influences from my wider family, like my grandparents and my aunts, were always a big, big part of our food story.
I know we're going to talk about, you know, your beginning career in the human rights as a human rights campaigner, right? But was food ever, as a child, talked about it as even a career possibility for many children of immigrants, at least here in the United States? You know, the idea of going into service, it's like, we didn't come to this country of opportunity for you to go serve others, you know, in that way. Was food on your radar as a child?
You know, it wasn't in terms of something that I imagined myself doing like I am now. But of course, you know, food was how my uncles, my aunts, my grandparents earned a living. And I think that anybody who grows up around farming, especially small scale farming, you end up with such a reverence for produce because it is hard to farm, you know. It's hard to be a small-scale farmer. Small-scale farmers make up so much of the global South. I think there was just this deep respect for it. So, you know, food never got wasted in our house because we knew what it took to grow it. And at the same time, I think food was just such a central part of how we connected with each other. I mean, I'm not just saying it. It's like we are a family of, like, foodies beyond compare. I mean, everyone's a critic. It's like someone cooks dinner and it is like Gordon Ramsay's there and they're like critiquing you about what you're doing and you should have added this or you should have done that or I would have done that. And like many children of migrants, for me, it was very much how I related most deeply to my heritage. I would say that politics was as well because of the human rights situation in Iran, but food really was probably the first thing because it was so visceral.
That's a perfect segue to talk about how you began to or came to the field of being a human rights, to work in the human rights field. Was that because of your family's experience in Iran and what it meant to be separate from them and to watch that unfold as a child in the UK? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, 100%. It was exactly that. And actually, you know, I do the work that I do and I have one sibling and she works for Doctors Without Borders. And like, you know, the life work of me and my sister has very much been around conflict and, you know, and human rights. So I was born in the UK, but when I was 3 months old, we went back to Iran. And, you know, we were just planning to stay a few months because my mom was studying for her PhD. But then, unfortunately, the political situation escalated. A very young uncle of mine, he was 25, he was arrested and then kind of executed. And we had kind of several family members put in prison. And then the war in Iraq started, so the borders closed. So, I mean, yeah, we ended up staying. and the whole of my childhood was really a reflection of that, constantly worrying about the safety of people we love, constantly worrying if when we said goodbye to people, whether we would see them again. Like, you know, it wasn't like at the forefront of our minds, but I think it was like so much, I think, trauma-induced behavior. It was just always there, you know, you never knew. When you're living with fear, you just never know what's going to happen. So I decided to become a human rights lawyer and I actually ended up going to law school. And then while I was there, I was like, yeah, I don't think law is for me, but I think that I definitely want to be using my voice. And for me, activism just felt like, you know, we need good lawyers and we need good activists and we need good creatives. We just need people on every level. So that's what started me working for nonprofits. And that's what I did for a very long time, you know, mainly supporting, I worked a lot on deaths in police custody. So supporting families who'd lost loved ones after police shootings or, you know, people who died in prisons or at the hands of the police. And then I did kind of moved on from that and spent quite a long time working in the aftermath of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars.
Even in your share now, your recounting of it, I could feel in my own body, right? And we're continents apart, right? And this is in the past, the parts that you are sharing of your lived experience, but I can sort of feel them viscerally, right? So I can only imagine living within that, holding that, navigating that, both intellectually, physically, psychically, spiritually. And as I understand, you reached a point at which there was a moment, as we say, in my field, in my creative field, the moment when everything changed, when you say, this isn't working. Can you walk us through that moment? You are a human rights campaigner and an activist, and you hit a wall.
Absolutely. So I'd been working on Israel-Palestine for a number of years, a very tough issue for all the reasons that we all know. And I was just getting those classic symptoms for a really long time of feeling really run down and constantly coming down with something and not sleeping well. And these things that I think we tend to numb and like just, you know, knock back a coffee or, you know, find some medicine or just push through. And then I just had a series of difficult things happen, like a few deaths, a breakup, you know, like a few little kind of things. Well, they're not small, actually. It's interesting that I just dismissed them in that way. So I suddenly had a little escalation of things happening in my personal life. And I went into work one day and I said to my manager, you know, I'm not feeling so well. I think I need to take like some time off. And like many bosses, he was like, well, it's not such a good time now, like maybe in a bit, like maybe like later this summer. And then, Tembi, I'll never forget it. I literally put my head in my hands and suddenly started crying. And I just kept saying, I just can't do this anymore. I just can't do this anymore. I just can't do this anymore. And my boss was a bit overwhelmed. He was just like this, you know, this guy who didn't really know how to handle like emotions. And he was like, oh, well, maybe you should take a break. And I was like, yeah. But long story short, I ended up actually being signed off work sick for a month, which was really difficult for me. It was a big shift in my identity. Like, I am so sick, I cannot work. What? Like, but I was in mental health crisis. And to cut an even longer story short, my work later, as it became clear that I needed a break, said that I could have a sabbatical. And so I took 6 months unpaid, but you know, I had a break and they said you could come back. And it was really on that journey that I guess transitioned to another chapter of my life. And now with the benefit of hindsight, I kind of really see it. It was a breakdown without a doubt. I had a complete nervous breakdown, but it was also a breakthrough. And sometimes I think, especially women, I feel like the more I hear other people's stories, it's almost as if sometimes we have to let ourselves break completely before we like listen to what's going on inside. But I'm glad that it happened, even though it was so hard.
You know, I thank you for sharing that. I think a lot of people can relate to that. And there's the path that we have set ourselves on. And then, and I often talk about the heroine's journey, there's that moment where you get a call to go in a different direction. And it becomes about, you know, that call can show up in many forms. And it can look like a breakdown. It can look like an illness. It can look like a car accident. It can look like a break. It can look like many different things. But you answered the call to listen to what was truly screaming from within, right? And you returned, as I understand, to your family farm in Iran. And it's on a farm around the rice fields and among the watermelon that you spoke of and the streams that you began to heal, but also, as I understand, began to sort of think about how you might use the experience and the storytelling that you learned and were very adept at as a human rights campaigner to sort of merge that with food and your own personal history.
I've always been convinced through my activism that one of the main precursors to social change is humanizing people, enabling connection to be formed, and understanding each other's stories. And Iran is a country which is really only seen through such a narrow political lens of its government. So I thought, well, wait a minute, is there something I can do with food? Because Persian food, it's a lot bigger now. But, you know, when this idea was, you know, starting out, it really wasn't. There weren't many cookbooks on it. In fact, there was one or two, or, you know, just a couple of prominent Iranian food writers. So this idea formed for my first book, The Saffron Tales, where I ended up traveling with a female photographer. And we traveled all around Iran, from the north to the south, to the east to the west, from the mountains to the deserts, to the rice paddies, to the tea plantations, to the, you know, cities. And we cooked in people's homes. And it was a collection of stories and recipes, which was a real gift from grace, really. I feel like that I get a bit emotional even thinking about it now, because I think, yeah, I'm just really grateful to my ancestors and my grandparents, and also my mom, for just installing that in me, because to be able to share some of the beauty and joy and love of that culture is just something I'm so passionate about.
Your book, The Saffron Tales, is both a revelation and an invitation, and it absolutely is a humanization, not only of your own personal history, but of, as you said, the people, not a government. And you really understand the power of narrative. I'm very interested in the process of how you collect these recipes and these stories, because my sense is that there's a great deal of intimacy around how you approach this. Am I right?
I wish I could say that there was some kind of grand plan of how I do it, but it's so spontaneous. I start by asking people I know before I travel to a place, do you know someone in that area? But mainly it's when I'm on the ground. You know, I tend to travel, I travel slow, deliberately. I spend kind of quite a long time in places. And so it's just, you know, you'll start a conversation with someone and then they'll give you a recommendation of a good cafe. And, oh, have you heard? And, or someone's, you know, sister or brother who's a really good chef. And it just flows so organically. I'm very clear from the outset when I approach people who I am and what my work is. And I often just tell people why I'm doing it. And I think most people just have got it straight away.
I want to pivot a little bit to talk about the way, with intentionality, this is, you know, to use a sort of capitalistic word, this is your business model, which is to sort of like, you know, go around the world to places that, and as we've discussed, humanize, go into home kitchens, not just restaurant kitchens, but home kitchens, and tell the stories, you know, as they are told to you. Was there ever an aha moment where you're like, ah, this is my voice in the world. This is what I can do. Was it a particular trip, a particular country, or did it evolve over time?
You know, it really did evolve over time. I continue to be shocked that I'm currently writing my fourth book, that I've kind of ended up in this realm. I just started out because I wanted to tell the story of Iran. And then I thought, well, maybe one more. And then, well, maybe one more. And then people seem to like them. And it just flowed. But it's interesting. You know, I'm sure you and lots of listeners will also resonate with this. I'm now wondering what next. So I do have another cookbook that will be out, and, you know, there'll be great recipes, and I hope everyone will enjoy the stories. But I think what's really exciting about life is, or for me anyway, is constantly kind of thinking, okay, so now this, how do we level up, or like, where does it go? You know, and I'm in a transition space with that right now, which is kind of, oh, when you're in transition, it actually doesn't feel great, because you're just like, what am I doing? What's next? What do I want to do? Da-da. But I'm learning now to trust that this space, because when we get that, for me, if we can, it's an indication that there's something bigger and better coming, and you just don't know what it is yet.
I love that you have shared this, and it opens up so many channels of conversation I want to have around it. Like that. But part of what this, you know, this podcast is about, and I've said it before, I'll say it again, is about, you know, it's these moments of lift, these moments when we make a pivot and we are seeking to lift our lives either into the next space or in closer to our heart song, as I say, right? And you know, it does feel uncomfortable, icky, sometimes even aimless, or like, right. what gives, you know, and it can feel a very disorienting. And yet we stay the course. And I love talking to women who just keep, you know, sort of nudging and pushing at the question to sort of say, where do I want to go? But I also know that there are people in your life who help you to hold that space as you go forward. Who are those people for you? Who helps you to lift your life?
Well, I feel like my mom just springs to mind straight away. She is one of the most inspirational people. I mean, probably everyone feels that way about their moms, but like, you know, she's just constantly been one of those people who really makes me and anyone, actually, she's a real coach to kind of women and makes friends with anyone, just getting people to believe in themselves and to believe that anything is possible. I think, you know, she's come from such a difficult background, hardships that I will never be able to even imagine. So I think she does. And I just feel really fortunate that I've got a really kick-ass group of female friends. A lot of them are just living their lives on their terms, you know, not necessarily conventional in the societal way, very independent, very audacious. And I get a lot of inspiration from them because everyone's just living their lives and not really trying to get stuck into what the culture says that they should do. So I think it's my sisters and my family. I would also say, just on that, I somehow have ended up being like the baby of my friendship group. And so a lot of my female friends are maybe anywhere between like 7 and 10 years older than me. And I don't really know how that happened, but it just has over the years. And it's only now that I'm just seeing what a gift that is. And I'm now getting to the age where I'm also like developing kind of younger friends. So I guess I just want to use this moment to say, intergenerational friendship, I mean, is 10 years, whatever. I feel like just developing friendships outside of our particular kind of age group can be so beneficial in so many ways. So I really encourage everyone to do that.
I completely co-sign on that. I have good friends who are well into their 70s, and I have people in my life who are in their mid-20s, and we all have something to learn from each other. And as women, I am always looking ahead to see, how did someone navigate that stage, right? There's so much wisdom for people ahead of us, so much wisdom. And then also, I understand I sit in a unique position to offer advice to younger women, right? Things that I wish someone had told me. So I completely co-sign on the intergenerational female and also male friendship, right?
Yes, you know? Yes, absolutely.
We've danced a little bit around something I want to talk about, which mm-hmm. is, I know, I think it was around 2011, around the time you had the breakdown in your boss's office, there was also a diagnosis of chronic fatigue syndrome. I think there are many listeners who have it is, and I know in my own life, it wasn't my physical illness, but it was my late husband's illness. Illness is can bring us to a moment, an inflection point, right, of change. And I know that you, or at least I've read, that you were very protective of how you care for yourself and how you respect your physical wellness so that you can do the work that you do in the world. I have some direct experience with that as well. And I want to just talk, just for listeners, if you're willing to share a little bit about, if we're going to do this sort of big work in the world, right? And we've got our team of people who help us do it. Our role in doing that work is also a kind of, you know, for lack of a better, you know, sort of the code word is self-care. But I think it goes much deeper than that. It is, can you speak to that a little bit?
Oh, I'd love to. It's something I'm so passionate about. And it's one of the reasons why I launched a Substack this year. Currently paused while I'm finishing my book, but please, if anybody's interested, do go and sign up. It's risingup at substack.com. And the theme of that is all about resilience, which is something that I really started to dig into from when I had my burnout. You know, I was suffering from such a deep exhaustion that wouldn't go away. And eventually I got diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome. And I'm putting that in inverted commas because actually Western medicine doesn't quite, I don't think, understand the energy body in the same way that perhaps Ayurveda or TCM, traditional Chinese medicine, does. And I went on quite a long journey with that. You know, I was so exhausted for like 6 months that even like a walk to the store and back and I'd just have to lie down. But slowly I started to kind of recovering, and I feel really, you know, blessed that I was able to. But what that installed in me is a real sense of protection and boundaries. I think, look, it's a big world out there. It's very loud. It's very messy. And I think, you know, we're encouraged again by the culture and society to really be expending all of our energy all the time. And I always share something that I got from a yoga teacher around that time, who said to me, look, you want to think of your energy like a bank balance, okay? You always want to be putting stuff in the savings account, right? And if you ever get too close, like to zero, that's a sign that like, whoa, I need to top up my energy, you know? And if you get into the red, a little bit you can deal with, you know? We all know you just get into the red, maybe a bit of rest. But once you go really in the red, you're screwed. So, you know, I now start thinking about the ways in which I can top up my energy, whether it's through like restorative activities, whether it's just through like switching off my phone, whether it's through like a walk, you know, somewhere beautiful, whether it's through like, you know, laughing a lot at a comedy special. You know, I think laughter is such an important part of resilience. So yeah, I'm really passionate about that because I want people to be the best versions of themselves for them, you know, their own health, for the health of the people around them, but also for the health of like the world we live in. But that has to start with, I think, proper boundaries. It has to start with cultivating joy. It has to start with compassion. And from those places, I think that's where we find the resilience and the strength to meet whatever challenge we find in the world, be that personal or political.
Is there a food that you cook to help you feel restored? Is there some go-to thing that is like, I'm feeling depleted, I'm in the red, I got an overdraft alert on my bank account, I need to go to the kitchen and do what?
You know, there really is, and no one has ever asked me that before. This is such a good question, and it came to me instantly. So it is dal and rice, and specifically, mung bean dal, split mung beans, which in Ayurveda, which is the traditional science of health in India, you know, my dad, actually, he's a doctor now, but he only first saw a Western doctor when he was at medical school because he just saw Ayurvedic doctors before then, right? But anyway, so they say that mung beans are the most digestible. So if you ever have any problems with beans or lentils, that's the one to go for. So I make that and I put kind of just some warming spices in it. It's not got a lot of heat, but it's got a lot of turmeric, cumin, garam masala, and some onions and garlic. So super kind of simple, and it's rich and it's creamy, and the lentils kind of break down. So they all come together, and I stir like a little bit of maybe coconut oil or butter through it. And then I serve that with a simple steamed rice. And so we've got the softness of the rice, which is really pillowy, and just you can scoop it up with a spoon. And then I always have like a little sharp, crunchy salad, like diced cucumber and tomatoes and red onions with a lovely kind of lemon and olive oil dressing. That is, there's a recipe for that in my next book, which isn't out yet. But yeah, I actually did that because it's like what I eat when I need some restorativeness.
Your description took me to church. Thank you. It felt so damn good. I was going to ask you, can we have that recipe? But we will wait. We will wait for the book. I think I know what personally lifts you, but I'm going to ask what personally lifts you. Just, I think you've said a walk, you've said connection with your friends, I know the dish you. Is there anything else that lifts you?
Dancing. I am a dancer. I feel like in another life, I definitely was a mover. And yeah, it is the biggest joy of my life. And actually in the pandemic, you know, in the really kind of intense kind of year or two where there wasn't a lot of that, I would be at home and I would just close my eyes and I danced a lot in the house and I still do that, but I would just close my eyes and imagine dancing anonymously in a crowded room where it's just dark so you can just completely let go. So that is my medicine, you know. It's one of the biggest pleasures of my life.
Thank you. What is a pivotal first meal that you made after loss?
I find that for me, when I go through periods of like emotional stress, I never do the comfort eating thing. So, you know, I never like reach for pizza or ice cream or what some people do. It's like my appetite disappears. It's really painful and sad, actually. So I've had quite a lot of losses in recent years, because I've had 5 pregnancy losses, 5 miscarriages. And so I've been in this cycle of grief quite a lot. And what I find helps me is soup. Like there is something very meditative about just chopping vegetables. Like soup is so easy, you know, it doesn't take anything of you, but I feel like it can give you so much, you know? So there would just be something about like chopping up like a big, lots of fresh organic vegetables, feeling that I was doing something really healing for myself, you know, at the same time, it was very undemanding. So I think that would be it, a big vegetable soup. It's so simple, but I think it's the most soothing for me.
At the end of your days, what do you want people to say about you?
Wow. I think I would like people to say that she always brought a smile to every situation. And she inspired others to feel better about themselves and the world around them.
Well, I know why I love you. I know why I love you. Yeah, I get it. I would want someone to say that about me as well. What would you want as your last meal? Is it the soup or is it the doll?
You know, it's something else. I'm going through all of my heritage with these answers, which is great. So the dal is like my, you know, Pakistani heritage. But my final meal would be from my mom's side. There is, well, you're in LA, so I imagine you'll have heard of this dish. But there is a very particular Iranian dish, very famous stew called ghorme sabzi. It's loads of herbs cooked down with kind of red beans and like lamb and dried limes. And it's just so evocative of the Persian kitchen. It reminds me of my family. It reminds me of home. It reminds me of feeling safe. It is just the perfect meal.
Yasmin, thank you so much for this conversation. I have loved every minute of it. It has inspired me. It has leveled me up. And I think listeners are going to love it.
Thank you so much. I feel so lifted and I'm so grateful for the podcast and all that you're doing. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
Lifted is developed, written, and produced by me and my one-woman producing team, Celia Cates. It is edited by Jamie Moss. Thank you for joining us. Stay tuned for our next inspiring episode.
Grand Canyon University's RN to BSN online degree program makes earning your bachelor's in nursing possible. Balance online coursework with local in-person clinicals to position yourself for potential leadership opportunities in the time you have from wherever you are, leaving room for what matters. Achieve your goals with your personalized plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.